IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 214 of the
Killing It Podcast.
I'm Carl, and I'm joined, as always, by Dave and Ryan. And we got some fun topics today, but we also have some, you know, stuff in the real world that we got to deal with. So,
well, Dave? I'm going to take it on there because I'm going to ask. Let's get a sense of the lay of land. We're talking, well, the government's still shut down. This may have changed by the time it drops. Right. But with that landscape, question of the day, how many plane rides do you have that are at risk right now? Are you thinking about that?
Well, as we record this, I'm flying in 2 days, and the government might be open by the time we're done recording this, but that may or may not help me out, right? Because there's an aftermath where things have to get back to normal. Luckily, I'm flying Southwest because it's a quick hop to Southern California, which means it's probably going to be delayed anyway, and I may not notice any effects of this. So, but then, you know, in a few days after that, I come back, and I hope by then it'll be straightened out. We'll see.
Yeah. See, I have out and back concerns on 3 different trips, and the getting back from the Thanksgiving trip to see family and everything, that might be the one that's most at risk of all. And boy, I tell you, I've actually considered the TikTok advice to, you know, just buy a backup ticket, and then you'll have twice the chance that you won't get canceled. And when I first heard that advice, I was like, I don't think you understand money or airplanes, but at this point in time, it's actually starting to sound a little less crazy.
I've got nothing personally. I'm sitting on my office chair the whole time. My wife is in Florida as we're recording this and has a flight back in 3 days. So I have, you know, through osmosis effects to this. If I get now, hers is back from Florida to DC. So, and on a, you know, mainline carrier through on a main service by carrier. So the likelihood of hers getting canceled is low. And as I told her, I said, the worst thing is you're in warm weather for an extra day or two.
Right.
Which is not necessarily that bad a thing.
So exactly. And, you know, I'm going to Irvine. So if I need an alternative, every major airline will give me 12 flights a day to Los Angeles. I just then have to Uber to Irvine.
Oh, yeah. Which is not so bad.
It's about a $150 Uber ride. I have done that one.
Well, today's episode is sponsored by the Small Biz Thoughts Technology Community. The best deal in online communities for IT business owners is the Small Biz Thoughts Technology Community. Memberships start at just $799 per year, and that includes a 5-week course at IT Service Provider University. Make sure to grab the details at smallbizthoughts.org.
And topic number one today, this is kind of an odd topic to be talking about in 2025, but I think it's worthwhile. Recently, Taco Bell said, hey, guess what? You can Venmo your tacos. Just go in and, you know, Venmo them some money and they will give you your food. And for me, this brings up the question, because Venmo is a subsidiary of PayPal, do we need Bitcoin? And this has been my question since day one. Is it useful for anything other than illegal activity? Because right now I have Venmo and Cash App and Apple Pay and Google Pay and 12 other things that, you know, everybody wants to put an app on my phone. And there's e-payments are everywhere, and they have basically a perfect record of what you bought and who you bought it from and when and so forth and so on. And you can challenge your things and whatever. I'm not sure that there's anything there that's left to be filled as a need, a legit need, by Bitcoin.
Well, wow, topic number two today. so Carl, I'm 100% with you. Like, But I think I want to actually try and take a moment and say, like, look, I've always said I think this is all a joke. But if I'm taking a quick moment and take a step back, let's try and look at the technology and think about how it might have been applied. I think the first thing is that we're discovering that that Bitcoin and cryptocurrency is not a currency. Like, that's how ultimately it is not, we do not need to replace money. I think there are two bits in this technology that I want to highlight as, hey, I think there's something here. There's some limited use for it. The first is, it is a digital asset. And in so much as arbitrary things sometimes have asset value, gold for me is an exact value of, like, gold's just a thing, right? We've just sort of declared it valuable because we've declared it valuable. I guess there's an argument that there's less of it, but it's not a rare earth mineral, or like, it's not something that actually like has value in that sense, because there's a bunch of gold out there. But we as humans need a way of having stored value. Bitcoin has a way of retaining digital value. And particularly for young people that are looking for more volatile assets, like, okay, I get some of that. I'm not participating, but I at least understand the value there. I think there is an argument to be made for distributed ledger technology. Like, if I'm thinking about blockchains, more like a distributed ledger, like the smart contract promise has never really come true, and but I think there's times sometimes when I'm like, well, a distributed ledger would have been really useful for that, like, you know. And so I want to carve out that I think there's two offshoots there, that like, maybe there's some value there if somebody can figure out better usage of it. But do I think this is mainstream in any way, and do I think it's a currency? Oh, no.
See, yeah, not a currency, but an asset is a perfectly reasonable way to think about this stuff. People pay a lot of good money to collect a lot of things that others in the world don't necessarily think are valuable. That's not new. That is the reason behind stamps and rare coins and other things that have entire industries of collectability and appreciating asset value. I'm perfectly on board with the mentality that you can use Bitcoin for those things, and not just in the form of a cryptocurrency that you can say, I own the currency, but that becomes the value exchange for holding assets in the digital world. That said, Carl, when you asked the question, is there a reason for it? I had several answers, but then you said, is there a legitimate reason for it? And I was like, oh, crap. Well, drug deals and ransomware and bribing public officials and all of the other things that it... Exactly. All the ways that you can use this for shenanigans, those continue to expand, and those continue to actually become more established and more mainstream. Like, if somebody had asked you 2 years ago to pay them a ransom for your data in cryptocurrency, you would have thought, A, that's stupid, and B, how in the world would I even do something like that? It's still stupid, but we all know how to do it now. It's there, and it has in that sense, it's gone mainstream. But the whole concept behind it of unbanking or debanking a currency so that it can operate according to market forces, for people who have all the capital and are looking for volatility to fuel speculative trades on the up and the down, that must sound like a really fun game to play. But to use that as the currency of a country or as the basis of trade internationally, those things are built on consistency and predictability, not speculation and variation.
Well, along the lines of e-payments, and getting away from Bitcoin, the other half of the question is, would MSPs be wise to take Venmo and Cash App and Apple Pay and all the other things? And does that make your life more complicated with regard to, if your clients are doing this, is there some PCI equivalent where now you got to keep track of how they store data? And right, because I know in Cash App, depending on how you've set it up, I can see when you've paid the babysitter and the lawnmower and
the dog you do it. I mean, I even do it wrong. Like, my quick answer is I have always taken the philosophy of you make it as easy as possible for clients to give you money. Right. Like that is my philosophy of sales is that you find a way to do that. You know, what that means, you might pick and choose. Like you may say that, you know, hey, you allow credit cards and you absorb the fee. You might say you allow credit cards, but the customer pays the fee, right? Because all are viable. You're just trying to make it, you make it easy for customers to give you money. I will also say yes. The way you take money does matter for PCI compliance, and you've got to think about compliance. But that's a broad statement on anything that customers do with their stuff. You need to be thinking about if you're doing a compliance offering, well, you better be all inclusive of all the ways that it does. And you may make choices, you know, based on your industry or regulation or anything along those lines that you may do something or not do something based on that. You know, I'll laugh and go like, hey, I run a media company. I don't have a whole bunch of compliance issues to worry about. So I can be very expansive of, yes, I will take your money via carrier pigeon delivered in a handbag. Like if that is the way you'd prefer to pay me, right? Because I don't have to think about it in the same terms, but not every market's the same.
And it might be a very generational thing, right? Those of certain colors of grayness in their hair might never be comfortable with this idea of paying for business goods and services with an e-pay technology. But I can absolutely assure you that we get those kinds of requests from customers who have a director of X, Y, and Z who has a budget with signing authority up to Y amount of dollars. Hey, can we Venmo this to you guys? Can you, I'm all about convenience, but I'm also about accelerating cash flow. And so if you can make this instantaneous and not, as we have a couple of clients who still insist, they send us a check, a physical check in the mail. My attitude is that's just a deliberate cash flow delaying strategy on their part. Because, yeah, they can say that they've paid the bill, but they don't actually have to account for it for another 2 weeks.
Oh, but you know what? We like the customers that pay. But I'm going to move us into topic number two. And it's a broad statement about where and how much cybersecurity is going to be now fully private versus a public-private partnership. There's been a lot of discussion about CMMC, the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification, which became effective on November 10th. At this point, the question then is, well, how much are they enforcing that? How much is their budget there for it? And they're even polling, the Pentagon's even polling small businesses to understand their readiness, as covered on the Business of Tech show, as well as stories I've been covering around CISA's staff and funding being slashed. And now external watchdogs have actually re-rated their readiness as several points lower than it was before. And so the question I want to bounce to you guys here is how much do you think the private sector is ready to take over all of the cybersecurity discussion, particularly when portions of it are monitoring of foreign actors and nation states and, being a centralized repository to distribute this information. How much is this going to become private and how well will that work?
Well, what's interesting for me is that there's on the private side, there's a lot of things where I could totally see somebody making money generating these alerts. Here's the activity we're seeing. And that's literally just the next step for many vendors who are out there. But as you alluded to, Dave, the monitoring all the routers coming out of North Korea, that's pretty illegal if you do it, right? So, there's a lot of stuff you can't do and private companies can't do on our soil. But it might be their opportunity to say, okay, well, we have this company in the Bahamas we do work with, wink, wink, nod, nod, and they give us these alerts and they're monitoring all of these things. And if it were on our soil, it'd be a different story, but I'm just buying alerts. So maybe there's an opportunity there. Big picture, this is a government operation as far as I'm concerned. We need to fund it and we need to enforce it. And so, there's a handful of things you can't say that are something other than the government's job. In fact, there's only a handful of things in the Constitution, and security is one of them.
See, and that's the thing is that I think of public versus private distribution of industry responsibilities in a number of different venues, right? You think about utilities and infrastructure, and you think about the air traffic control system. You think about these things that we all depend on as foundational elements of a functioning system and on which we build our own innovations for commercial offerings, right? The commercial offering motive is never to make it equally good and effective for every single person. In fact, the psychology of competitive differentiation says, I need to make sure that mine is different from yours in meaningful ways so that someone would choose my commercial offering instead of another one. That is exactly the opposite motivation that we need to drive effective foundational cybersecurity practices. I think that there are things that private industry can and must do in cybersecurity. It still stresses me out a whole lot that we've just all kind of settled into the aftermarket cybersecurity mentality where we are, you know, you can make a server, you can make a router or an application that is inherently not secure, and you can sell that thing into the world and go, hey, that's cool. But in my brain, that's the same as selling a car that doesn't have brakes and then saying, no, there are brakes available aftermarket. And if you really care about those things, please go ahead and buy them on your own. We're not responsible. Except we are, because it's not just you slowing your car down. It's the system requirement preventing you from slamming into me when we're out there driving on public infrastructure. That's exactly where this comes down in my mind. We cannot afford commercial motivation at infrastructure operating levels because that will create fiefdoms. It will create an inherent separation among populations. And that's the opposite of what we were trying to do with the internet.
See, I'm going to put this in the context of, I'm fascinated right now by Cory Doctorow's book, Incitification, right? We're just talking about the degradation of platforms and the continued extraction of value on end users by platforms. And I want to just take a quick moment and tell all the listeners, like, first off, you should read the book. It's a really, really good book. The principle is there. But now apply that idea of the principle to cybersecurity. Are you mad, listeners, MSPs, about the SSO tax that you have to pay extra for single sign-on? Are you mad about that? Now I want you to consider the idea that you might have to pay to understand vulnerabilities. I want you to understand that information sharing, you might have to have another subscription on top of everything else that you do just to get the information. Oh, and by the way, there isn't necessarily going to be an impartial provider of this. We're going to rely on private industry to completely be impartial on this. How well do you think that's going to work? and by the way, the same provider, when we think about the same platform providers that are doing that, are you comfortable with them being in charge of that?
Functions work well with private industry. I mean, to be honest, space flight, I think, the competition there is good, but it's paid for by the government, ultimately. On the other hand, if we got rid of the Postal Service and FedEx was in charge of mail, there's a whole lot of the country that would no longer get mail.
Right, that wouldn't get mail, right?
So we have to decide, something that's outsourceable?
All right, where does this fit on the spectrum, right? And I look and say, particularly if you think about security. I've always want to liken cybersecurity to its physical pieces. I want you to think of them as physical attacks. I want you to put them in the same context. I always say, if there were gangs of criminals banging on business doors every single day, walking down the street, just mobs of them, we'd fund this really fast, right? But because it's all done in cyber, it isn't. And what makes it different? There's no actual difference. They're still stealing. They're still violating. It's still a law enforcement. There's a component of it that is public safety. I just keep looking and saying, I want us to push back as an industry and send a message of no. I think this is really important. This is stuff we should fund. This is, and by the way, extend it out to the military. If you believe in investing in, the military for protection, cyber is the future of all of this, that is a public component. And it has not just a military operation, it's the public portion as well.
See, and I'll take that one half step further, right? Not only are there things that should be government and will benefit all of us, and there are other things that should be done by private industry, I'll take that the half step further that says there are things that must be done by private industry and by customers, and that comes in the form of regulatory compliance. Now, I know that's been a thing. It's a sales pitch and a FUD factor in our industry since the dawn of the conversation about cybersecurity. Like, oh, no, the boogeyman is coming. Give me all your money. That's not the right way to say it. But to say you are not okay to be in our digital community unless you meet the following requirements for cyber hygiene. If you don't operate that way, then thank you very much. You're not welcome in polite society. I think we ought to have real teeth in those kinds of protections for digital assets, for data, for IP, etc. I think that's only something that can be required by the government, but then implemented by private industry.
One final note, and that is on CMMC, I think it's actually one of the best well-crafted laws that the government's come out with for regulating businesses and how we interact with each other. It's kind of the exact opposite of HIPAA. We learned all the lessons from HIPAA and said, okay, let's not do that with cybersecurity. So CMMC is really good, but if no one's going to enforce it, it doesn't matter how good it is.
That is 100% correct. 100%. All right, guys, let's shift over to topic number three. And I want to talk about a growing gap in the world of technology between inventing cool new stuff and actually adopting and getting ROI from all of that cool new stuff. As a general observation, I will observe that the speed of technology innovation has accelerated dramatically in certain categories, but at the same time, the speed of technology adoption has not. That's not because the technologies aren't good. It's not because they're not potentially valuable. It's because they're being adopted by humans who work in organizations who have A, comfort with the way things are currently being done, and B, discomfort with change and new things, and especially when those things cost money. We announce all kinds of new technologies out there in the world, 3D printing and IoT and all of these additive manufacturing technologies that were going to revolutionize the world. And yet now they sit over in the dustbin of the technology industry of, I mean, that was kind of an interesting idea, but they never achieved either mass market adoption to get the ROI or the economies of scale to bring down the costs of such things. So my observation is we have a real problem in the world where we're not getting the next gen, right? Like, we're not getting IoT 4.0 when it has legitimate, real, and affordable benefits that we can deliver because nobody bothered to go through the work of adopting versions 1, 2, and 3, right? I think that as a technologist by brain and by DNA, I think innovation is what leads society forward, and technology is going to be the vanguard of that. But if we invent stuff faster than customers can adopt it, are we actually moving society forward, or are we leaving potentially valuable technologies on the roadside of history? What do you guys think about this?
I question the premise because there's some things, AI is the most obvious example, that are being adopted ridiculously fast, like unbelievably faster than anything in history. I think that if you think of it, like, there's always a percentage of things that do get adopted and the percentage of things that don't, right? We love to look back at all the silly things that people thought they could do with electricity, which pretty much all of them amounted to giving yourself, you know, shock therapy, right? But we don't do all of those things because they turned out to be stupid and nobody wanted to expose themselves to that. So, you know, a tiny, tiny percentage of things we could do with electricity, like motors and lights, well, those things took off because they made sense in the real world. I think those percentages of adopted and not adopted are pretty much the same. It's the massive expansion of how many things are entering the market. That might be a place where you should look for what's not being adopted and what is.
Yeah, and I always think things find a home. Like valuable stuff finds a home, and sometimes it's too. It's all about timing, right? Like it's an idea comes out and it's far too early for the market. That doesn't mean it won't eventually find its home or eventually find its application. There's a lot of bad ideas out there, right? Like, let's just call it out there. There are a lot of bad ideas, and that's okay. That is how we cycle through and figure out the ones that work. I will also observe that, like, there's a real difference between, like, invention and adoption.
Right.
I like this space because that's where we all play, right? We're implementers more than inventors often for this audience. And so you need a bunch of things flowing at you to figure out, like, well, does that make sense? And oftentimes the inventor doesn't even necessarily know what the thing will be useful for. It will take the adopters figuring that out. There's value to that being done, and things happen at when they're supposed to happen based on need. In particular, right now, I keep thinking about the fact that I think we're in a space where data is now becoming more and more of the obstacle. If I think about some of the adoption barriers that have happened over the past 20 or 30 years, a lot of them were very technological. Like, you know, we didn't have enough bandwidth. We didn't have enough, you know, of capacity and such. But now we're actually reaching the point where we have most of those basic things all taken care of. And the real adoption problems come into, like, customers that aren't ready for that. We talk about AI. I've had a number of conversations where literally the customer cannot describe the process well enough for it to be automated. Right. And that is no technology problem. That is a business problem. That is completely a business problem. Not true for all, you know, for all customers, but there's a lot of them that are, right? There's a lot of them that are not thinking that way. And so, like, now the gaps are becoming interesting because they're more around people and process than they were about technology.
Well, and see, I think you've hit on where I think the golden nugget in this is. I'm not concerned with things that were invented that were bad ideas. I'm looking at things that get invented in the world of technology that never achieve maturity, not because they weren't good, but because we didn't fully enable the customer to actually adopt and take advantage of those things. I would say that is in the next phase of our industry. That's the literal job description of an MSP, right? What was a job description based on take the things that are already established in the marketplace and deployed by customers and monitor, manage, and optimize those things, make sure they continue to work. I'm going to take it to the next step and say our job description in the next phase is not just managing things that are already in and effective, but finding a way to unlock the trapped value of technology investments that could drive benefit. Both of you guys have used AI as an example, and I agree. I think that there are 99% of individuals who are trying this out, and there's probably 10% of organizations who are having effective adoption of these kinds of capabilities. But this is the thing that is true about all new technologies. By definition, when they come out, the end user has no idea how to use them. We also know that these startup corporations are never going to staff, no matter what their economics are, they're never going to staff a customer implementation or customer success function. Like OpenAI, Microsoft, Google, all these guys, they're never going to hire a staff of technicians to ensure that it is deployed effectively, integrated with your data, that it's actually adopted in your organization. That's why this channel exists, but only if we can get to the point of our value, not saying, I will manage what you already know about established technology and I'll do it for 5% cheaper than the competition, to I will help you evaluate and prepare and unlock the value of new technologies that you don't know how to use and that you aren't yet convinced could be valuable.
Let me say one tiny thing and then I'll let Dave close. You know, one thing that could be going on here is that there's so much good stuff out there, but we don't realize that we're early adopters. And that a lot of this stuff, you know, what happens to early adopters, they have to pay 10 times as much, right? And it may be like a client sees what they could do and their consultant comes to them as an actual solution provider, shows them how to solve a complex problem that they can't quite understand, but the cost is $1 million, right? Well, okay, maybe we have to wait until that cost is reasonable for businesses to actually adopt.
You know, I continue to think a lot about the value of aggregators and experts, right? And I think the value continues to be having the largest view that you can and acting as an intelligent filter to your clients, like providing that bit. So you've got to be looking, but your value is that filter process. And it leads to, that's why I want more stuff out there, because it gives me more stuff to filter through.
Exactly. Job security.
Job security.
Well, luckily, we had a great show. We need your help. Please like it and share it and tell all your friends about it. And we'll see you next time. In the meantime, this has been episode 214 of the Killing It, podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.